You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. Candidates for the contested Virginia Senate District 17, House District 25, and the Albemarle County Commonwealth's Attorney participated in a forum sponsored by the Senior Statesman of Virginia. The candidates spoke at the Wednesday, September 9, 2015 meeting of the Senior Statesman. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. Our podcast is entitled State Candidates Forum. Here's Bob Gibson.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and welcome, everyone. We are in for a nice hour and a half conversation with candidates, first for the Virginia General Assembly, and then for the Albemarle County Commonwealth's Attorney's Office. We have an excellent forum planned. First, we'll have a candidate for the Senate District 17, which includes the eastern half, roughly, of Albemarle County, plus counties to the east. And our candidate is approaching the stage, Ned Galloway. Welcome, Ned. Ned is a Democrat running for Virginia Senate against incumbent Republican Senator Bryce Reeves of Spotsylvania County. He has served as an at-large member of the Albemarle County School Board since his election in November of 2011. Galloway also has served as president of the Dunlora Community Association. A little bit about the ground rules today. Each of the candidates will have 5 minutes to make an opening statement, and then we'll take questions from the moderator and from the audience. So if you see someone passing out cards and you would like to ask a question, my only request is that you write legibly, print preferably, and make it so I can understand the question and read it. And I'll try to get to as many questions from the audience as we can get to this afternoon. There will be three segments, 20 minutes for the state Senate contest. Unfortunately, Bryce Reeves had a prior commitment and could not make the event today, so Ned Galloway is the only candidate with us. Then we'll go to the 25th House District, where we will have Angela Lynn, a Democrat who is challenging Steve Landis in the 25th House District. Steve Landis, the Republican incumbent, has been 20 years in that seat, which includes western Albemarle and parts of Augusta and Rockingham counties in the valley. Then we will go to the Commonwealth's Attorney's race, where we have both candidates running in Albemarle, and that will be the longer of our segments this afternoon. The moderator will select from written questions submitted by members of the audience and may ask questions of my own. If a question is directed to only one candidate, the moderator may ask the other to respond. We will ask that candidates respond to questions within a two-minute time limit. So first up is Ned Galloway. Take it away, Ned.
Thank you, Bob. Do I need to turn on here? How's it? Oh, there. Oh, hello. There it goes. The benefit of going first, you get to test out the technology. So good afternoon. I want to first start off by thanking the Senior Statesman of Virginia for holding this forum. It's incredibly important for candidates to have a chance to come before voters, tell them who they are, why they're running. The Senior Statesmen have always held a number of different forums, not just around elections, but other pertinent topics that are important to local folks. So I'm very appreciative of this organization. So my name's Ned Galloway. I'm going to tell you a little bit about who I am and why I'm running, and that should take up the 5 minutes. And keep me on the clock there, Bob, if I get a little wordy. So I'm originally from Wheeling, West Virginia. That's where I grew up. My dad delivered beer for a living, and my mom worked in a plastics factory. She kind of managed the factory and the transportation around the things that went out. My grandmother is who practically raised me, so I went to public education my entire life. And, you know, education is my passion. I first learned that passion. My grandmother, at the age of 60, went back to college and earned her business degree at Wheeling Jesuit College in my hometown. And so when I would go home after school, it wasn't just do your homework, it was she was sitting down and do your homework with me. So I learned how to be a good student, practice what she was showing me to do.
After graduating high school, I actually attended Wheeling Jesuit College for a year as a pre-law major and decided that I wanted to transfer to Ohio University to become a theater arts and drama major, which I did, and went through their program and earned my BFA at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. Upon graduating Ohio, I was hired as a guest instructor initially with Shaker Heights High School outside of Cleveland, at their high school where I taught, and then I earned my teaching certificate at John Carroll University and became a full-time faculty member on the Shaker Heights High School staff. I met my lovely wife Julie in Shaker. She's from there, and we got married when we were still in Shaker and had the first of three children. And that's when Central Virginia called. I decided to leave teaching and leave Shaker and attend the Curry School of Education here at the University of Virginia. So I entered into the doctoral program of social foundations there. In the meantime, I've had two more children. So Caitlin, my daughter, is 13. Maggie, my second daughter, is 9. And AJ, my son, is 6. And having some children while you're working on a dissertation stretches the time out a little bit. But I'm proud to say that I was able to finish my doctorate. And in the meantime, my wife left the car business. She was in the car business for a while, and she went back to school as well, and eventually earned her nursing degree at UVA. So I'm very pleased. It was a nice personal moment when my wife and I got to walk the lawn together, her earning her nursing degree and me earning my doctorate in education. And she's now employed by the University of Virginia as a pediatric intensive care unit nurse. So 4 years ago, I ran for and won the at-large seat on the Alamore County School Board, and for the last 2 years, I have served as its chair. So as a former teacher with somebody that has done graduate-level work in education and who served on a school board, education is my number one campaign priority, and I've been telling folks will be my number one legislative priority. There's a lot of politicians who, every time they get a mic in front of them, will always tell you that education is important to them. But there's very few that go on and actually act that education is very important, make it their legislative priority. So that is going to be my legislative priority. I'm just convinced that the best investment we can make is in our children, and that yields results and returns for all of us. They are the ones that will be our future leaders, our future health providers. They will be our future politicians who are making policy, and they're going to be our future entrepreneurs. So our economy, our health economy, everything is vital to how we're educating the folks that are coming behind us who will be leading us in this world. Now, the other reasons I got into this race was to make sure that we continue with good job creation. Job creation is also connected to education. All right? We have to make sure not only that folks who are in the economy are receiving repurposed training as needed if they want a better job, but we also need to make sure that if there are folks leaving K-12 education, that they have easy access to enter the workforce and are ready to go if they want to earn a living. And then the third reason that I've been running is stating that it's time to get politics out of the expansion of Medicaid debate, that we need to start looking at it from a viability of providing insurance to those who need it, having taxpayer dollars not leave our state to not return, but also to make sure that the Virginia business economy is not on the sidelines as we watch this new health economy grow. Virginia is number one in business. It needs to be number one in the health economy business and stop sitting on the sidelines. So we need to get the political barrier that's in front of that out of the way. How am I doing on time?
About a minute left.
Oh, I got a minute left. I'm there. Does that mean there?
15 seconds.
Oh, well, then we're there. I'll be happy to answer questions today.
Thank you, Ned Galloway. If anyone has questions in the audience, please ask for a card, and they'll be passed up here. I'll start with this one, Ned. What should be done to better care for the mentally ill individuals in our community, especially considering that more than a quarter of those inmates in the Albemarle-Charlottesville Joint Regional Jail are taking medication for mental health problems? What can we do better than just putting these folks in jail?
Well, like I said, when we talk about expanding Medicaid, that helps bring resources and dollars into the state that allows us to be used for the things that we decide need to be focused on. So I know mental health has been a major issue for folks in the last couple of years especially. It seems to be a bipartisan concern for both sides of the aisle. So when we talk about providing the type of services we need to these folks, whether they're in an institution now or whether they're seeking care, that we have to have the resources there to be able to provide the services they need. And that's both identifying those who have mental health issues and then also providing them the care that they deserve to help them cope. So if we don't have the resources and we don't have the leadership to prioritize the resources, then it's not going to happen. And expansion of Medicaid is a way to help gain those resources. I mean, we're passing up on dollars right now that are leaving the state not to return that could be used in this effort. But the another piece of this is we've all been hearing about the $500-some million surplus that Virginia has received. Well, if we had expanded Medicaid, there'd be another $125 million there to use. That's money that we could be, the state legislator and the leaders in state government could be saying, these are resources available to us to go after an issue like this to help solve the issues that are out there.
Second question. On inflation-adjusted basis, state per pupil funding is down about $800 per pupil from 2008. What can you do about that?
Well, again, it's, you know, a budget is a statement of priorities. And when you go into a budget season, you know, anybody that goes in there and says that it's always going to be this way year in and year out, I don't think is approaching the conversation in a proper way. However, you know, I agree with the governor. He did protect K-12 education as they had to go through cuts over the last budget cycle. He's already been in front of money committee saying that K-12 education will be his focus going into the next budget cycle. And it is vital to the state to return and take the burden off of local governments to get the investment back into K-12 so that your local government doesn't have to continue either deciding to cut services or raise your local taxes. So education funding and SOL reform as part of that are going to be my number one priority when I get down to Richmond. So I want to be in the room when the budget priorities are being discussed. I will be there fighting to make sure funding is returned to the K-12 education environment. And it'll be obviously pertinent of me to form relationships and develop the relationships I need with the other lawmakers down there to make that happen. So I will be collaborative. I think public education is something we all can get behind. And I think that there is a will with folks focusing on it as their number one issue to make it happen.
Next question. Do you believe redistricting should be done in Virginia on a nonpartisan basis?
So, you know, yes.
Why?
Both parties are to blame for this, but it's just way past time for politicians to continue to draw their boundaries. I mean, the why is because it shouldn't be in their hands. There are ways that these boundaries can be drawn that are nonpartisan, it's independent of politics, and it puts the power back into the voters' hands to decide who they want to represent them. If you don't have a choice, then why are, I mean, in some of these districts, there's a choice at the ballot, but there's no real choice. It's so slanted in the favor of one over the other, the voters really are not being able to exercise their right of who they would like to represent them. So, you know, we're sitting just across the street from districts that were attempted to be redistricted out by my opponent. Just this past session, Bryce Reeves attempted to redistrict Democratic-leaning precincts out of the 17th back to Cree Deeds, who said, you know, this is just a political move, and pull some Republican ones in. Well, he only won by 226 votes, so I understand the reason for doing it, but I don't think that thank goodness the governor said, no, we're going to veto that effort. All right, so it is past time. We need to put these districts have to be put into the hands to be determined by people that will do so, that are not driven by their political playbook, so that they can go, the power of the voter to decide who they want to represent them will really be a true choice for them. So the work of Virginia 2021, I'm incredibly, I'm obviously very supportive of their efforts, and I have been, and I hope, you know, it's going to take politicians who are going to say, I'm going to give up this political power in order to make this happen. And, you know, in this election, there's an interesting thing. Bryce Reeves serves on the Privileges and Elections Committee down in Virginia. So does Cree Deeds. Cree Deeds is the ranking Democrat on that committee. If the Democrats regain the majority in the state Senate, Cree Deeds becomes the chairman of Privileges and Elections. Cree Deeds has spoken out in support of a nonpartisan independent redistricting commission for years. And it would be nice to join a leader like that to make it happen. Because I'm okay with letting the voters decide who they want to represent them, and I'm not okay with politicians continuing to try to favor their political careers by being able to draw those lines. So I'd like to get to work on that right away.
Thank you. Ned Galloway, what is your position on uranium mining in Virginia?
So that is something that you know, I've come out against. I'm not for the return of that of uranium mining. It's an issue that obviously I have found that when you're being on the school board, I've been getting up to speed on the environmental issues a lot over the last 4 months. But that one was an easy one to say that I'm not in favor of returning to uranium mining. I don't think it's safe. This state has to start leaning towards and politicians who are in the position to make policy need to start figuring out ways to further energy policy that's renewable and sustainable and stop the reliance on non-renewable resources.
An official with the League of Women Voters of the Charlottesville area is dismayed, she says, at incumbents declining to debate their challengers for office. What measures would you take to ensure transparency and accountability to your constituents?
So, I guess I can't pass a law that requires them to show up to debates or forums. So you have to be... I had a person ask me a question not too long ago, but what does leadership mean to you in terms of wanting to be a policymaker or to serve in the state Senate? And he said, think about it for a few seconds before you respond. He wanted me to give not just a flip answer. So I started to talk about, well, I think you need to be present and attentive. When it comes to voters and your constituents, you need to be present and attentive. You need to be collaborative with them as your constituents to determine what works, what doesn't work when you're thinking about policies that you're going to vote for or against. And then you need to be responsive, both responsive before to the needs and the concerns that are voiced to you and responsive afterwards to answer to your vote. And I think that's true when you're thinking about the people that you serve with as well. Now, what does that mean exactly? Well, in terms of transparency, it means that as an elected official, I'll continue what I think I do a good job of on our school board. When a policy comes up that's important to people, I get out there and I talk with them before I make a decision so that I not only just understand it from what my staff is telling us, but it's also to understand how it's going to impact people if a decision is made. And then I'm going to listen to all sides of it. It's not just going to be one side or the other, to truly learn and understand it. And then I'm going to explain to them my thought process on how I'm going to make a voting decision. And then after the vote is made, I'm going to go back out to the same folks and explain myself, explain my vote. That is what is the only way I know to be a public servant. That's what I think it means to be a public servant. So when I go down to Richmond, you're not going to not see me. I'll be present and attentive. I'm going to be collaborative with the voters and the constituents of the 17th. And I'm going to be responsive to your concerns that you voice. And then I'm going to answer to those concerns after votes by coming back out and making sure that you hear from me. And that's beyond forums, that I know that these things are really good during campaign season, but it's vitally important during session, lead-ups to session, and after session to make sure you're out in the community in a variety of ways to have access to folks.
Ned Galloway, do you believe there is enough traffic enforcement in Albemarle County on local roads, state highways? Do you believe that the county should have more red light cameras or more speed cameras?
I wasn't anticipating a question like that for this forum today. Here's how I would respond to that. I think law enforcement in Albemarle County is not funded to the level that it needs to be. And as a constituent and a voter in Albemarle County, that's incredibly concerning to me. So that's not candidate Ned talking. That's Father Ned and voter Ned and taxpayer Ned of Albemarle County talking. So what does that mean? That means the state has to not only return to funding levels and stop passing down mandates to the locality because it's inhibiting your local board of supervisors from providing the level of service you deserve as members of this county. See, every time, be it VRS mandate to the school division or a stormwater mandate, or if it's a line of duty act requirement that they pass the cost on down to the localities, as soon as they pass a mandate down to you, down to your local leaders, it puts them in a situation without the funding to follow to say, well, we either have to cut a service to now pay for this, or we have to go to your property tax and raise your taxes in order to offset the revenue loss. That's something that state leaders should not be doing. Okay? They need to, if they're going to send a mandate down to the localities that they think is important enough, then they need to make the funding decision on it as well and answer to the voters themselves, not put the onus on your local board of supervisors. They cannot sustain continuing going back to your property tax by sending these mandates down. And with the level of growth that we're seeing in Albemarle County, services, demands on our infrastructure, and demands on our capital are only going to continue to grow. I mean, you see it with someone, you know, locally here we have the Commonwealth Attorney race, which we're going to be hearing about today. I mean, Denise Lunsford, when she's running her office, her budget, if a mandate comes down from the state that state leaders don't take up and make a decision on, she's decided, well, now I have to either fight for a maintenance of budget or go advocate to my board of supervisors to raise taxes. She does a great job with the budget she has. She does not need to be put into position with the work she's doing to have to go advocate like that to a board of supervisors. And the state is making that happen in your localities. Your local revenues are being sucked up by folks that are down in Richmond who do not have the courage to have conversation about tax policy and funding things that they say are important. That's something that I'm going to work to change.
Thank you. In your opinion, should Virginia pass a law banning fracking?
Yeah, being from West Virginia, this is something that I've been paying attention to with folks that still live in my home state who've been talking about it. It goes back to the long-term view. I mean, when you think, I make a parallel to why education's so important to me. When I see my six-year-old and I see other six-year-olds and investing in them, that's an investment in the future that's 20, 30, 40 years down the road. Okay? And that's an investment in all of us. So when I look at policies that are around energy that's saying that that's not a sustainable way to go, I'm curious. I just don't believe that that's the right investment we should be making. Now, fracking can be very damaging to the land. It can be very damaging, and it looks like it could be, especially in Virginia with earthquakes and things like that, that there could be problems with that. But my overarching philosophy is I don't believe we should be investing in the type of things that are not going to be sustainable energy resources for us. I'd rather us focus on things that are renewable in terms of wind and solar, which this state seems to be starting to move towards a little bit. But I would rather stay away from issues like fracking, drilling off of our coast, and those. They're just not long-term vision items that will work for us.
Last question. What is the nicest thing that you can say about your opponent?
What is the nice? Nobody's asked me that yet. You have to be careful and think through questions sometimes. You know, Bryce is somebody that I've not had a lot of interaction with Bryce. My interactions with Bryce have been on the school board. I've been down to his office in Richmond. I have he's been to some of our legislative days in Albemarle County. The things that I could say is he seems like he is a good family man. I mean, it's hard to say, you know, there's nothing when you get into these kind of political campaigns where people say this, that, and the other that suggests that he's not a great father to his children. I would have to probably say that I would agree with that. I've not heard anybody come out and say that he's neglecting his family or his kids. So that's something that I would have to say.
Thank you, Ned Galloway. Thanks for coming for this afternoon's forum.
That went fast. Thank you.
Our next candidate is Angela Lynn, a Democrat running for the House of Delegates in Virginia, House District 25, which has been represented the last 20 years by Republican delegate Steve Landis of Augusta County. Angela is a Whitehall resident, former intergovernmental and external affairs worker for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. The district stretches from western portions of Albemarle County through Augusta County to Rockingham County. Angela Lynn joined FEMA in 2007, and before that received a master's degree in higher education administration from the College of William and Mary in 1998. Welcome, Angela.
Thank you. Well, as Bob just mentioned, I'm Angela Lynn. I'm running in the 25th District, which is a very large part of Albemarle County. It has seven precincts, and then it rolls around Waynesboro and grabs a few precincts in Rockingham County, and then it rolls around Stanton and goes through Augusta County all the way to the West Virginia border. So as you can see, this is a very large gerrymandered district. But the reason I'm running is because in 2013, I went to vote, and I wanted to see someone on the ballot that represented the values and the beliefs that I shared, and I was very surprised there was no challenger to the incumbent. But then when I found out why, I knew I had to take a stand, so I'm running to represent all voters, not just the special interests. So, and my concerns have been the same as a military wife when I rolled around the country and lived in different communities. I served in those communities in different capacities. I was a teacher. I was a community volunteer. I was a small business owner. I worked in higher education administration. And then I joined the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and I was a disaster and recovery response specialist. So I went to many people's homes and many people's businesses, and I helped them to restore the vitality of their communities. And after I got a chance to work in FEMA, I came back to Albemarle, and now I serve on two boards. I serve on the Department of Social Service Advisory Board, and I serve on the Public Recreational Facility Authority. One takes care of the people, and the other takes care of the land. And I'm very fortunate to be able to serve my community here in Albemarle on those two boards. When I speak to voters, and when I'm at their homes or in their businesses here and around in my district, there's three issues that seem to resonate. One of them is redistricting. They would like to see compact districts with open and fair elections and local representation. Another is Medicaid expansion, because they don't want to see billions of hard-earned taxpayer dollars going to other states when it could be coming back here and serving over 400,000 underinsured or uninsured Virginians and creating jobs right here. And a most important issue that seems to be very much on the whole district's mind is stewardship of our lands. Because if Richmond isn't going to fight for the localities to be able to take care of our lands, then what are we saying to the people who live here, who want to protect and live here and rely on the resources? So thank you for having me today, Senior Center, and all of the people who came out, because I'm very interested in you getting to know me and getting to know the issues of this race.
Thank you, Angela Lynn. What is your position on uranium mining in Virginia?
I oppose uranium mining in Virginia because I don't think it's necessary, and I think we have resources in our land here in Virginia that are more valuable and more sustainable for us to protect. So I oppose it.
In your opinion, should Virginia pass a law banning fracking?
Again, the sustainable resources that we have, the natural resources, are one of the reasons we live here. We are stewards of the land, and it takes a lot of work. There are a lot of people who work very hard to keep it that way. So they should have the voice and the input of saying what happens here. I don't believe that they have any interest in fracking, and they don't see this being something that is beneficial in the long run to Virginia.
Do you believe Albemarle County has sufficient traffic law enforcement? Would you like to see more red light cameras and speed cameras?
I have a lot of faith in our supervisors and our planning here in Albemarle County and in other localities' supervisors and planning, and they have a vested interest in making sure the right things happen in their community. So I'd have to say that if they wish to see more funding go into the cameras, that's something that I would trust their judgment in. However, the funding isn't there to actually be adequate for our policing, like as we should have it always in our communities. Public safety and our peacekeepers need the funding to have a good, solid relationship with the community.
Angela Lynn, what should be done to better care for the mentally ill individuals in our community, especially considering that more than a quarter of the inmates in the city county jail are being treated with medication for mental illness?
Mental health issues have always taken a back seat to physical health issues, and I don't think there's very many families who don't have something in mental health that affects them personally. So what I'd like to see is more funding go into mental health facilities and into the people who are working with the people who have developmental disabilities or intellectual disabilities. Are those Virginians who suffer in those areas do not have the facilities to go to proper diagnosis, care, medication. So I think we are very remiss, and it's disgraceful that we aren't taking care of this population, and it's beyond time.
Again, a League of Women Voters official from the local area says she is dismayed that the incumbents are declining to debate their challengers for office. What measures would you take to ensure transparency and accountability to your constituents?
The voters elect the legislators. The legislators work for the voters. We are obligated to answer to you. We're obligated to answer to the votes that we have cast, to the positions that we take, and to justify them. How can you do that if you're not communicating with them? How can you do that if you refuse to go and face them after elections or before elections or after sessions or before sessions and let them know that their desires will be represented? I would be the first to say that I think an educated voter, a well-informed voter, is the best voter. So they can't. You're denying that voter that information that they need to be a good citizen, and everybody should be able to want to vote with the confidence of knowing that they know who they're voting for and why.
On an inflation-adjusted basis, state per pupil of funding for education is down $800 per pupil from 2008. What are you willing to do about that?
Well, I was a middle school teacher and a high school teacher and a higher education administrator, so I know this issue very well. I know that administrators and teachers and parents and students are facing hardships because we haven't had the funding. I know that we're losing professors from JMU and UVA to go elsewhere. So I would fund education at all levels, especially there is a precedent with looking at pre-K. And it's interesting that Delegate Landis in 2012 was the only member of the House, the only one, to vote against pre-K funding. And he not only voted against it once, but twice. So now to add insult to injury, the Speaker of the House has promoted him to being on the pre-K commission. So I kind of find this to be disgraceful, and I feel that if I were elected, I would fund the entire educational program and make sure that Virginians get the quality of education that they deserve.
Who or what is the barrier to passing redistricting reform?
Passing redistricting reform came about this year with in the General Assembly, there was a bill that was about having redistricting in the legislative, similar to the one that Virginia 2021 had presented in an independent commission. And the redistricting didn't take place because my opponent, Steve Landis, serving on the Privileges and Election Committee, was the one that voted that down. So now Virginia taxpayers are looking at millions of dollars in legal fees, both at the federal and state level. And that special session that they just had cost Virginia taxpayers $50,000 a day, and nothing was done. So redistricting is something that Virginians would like to see happen, but they don't want to pay for illegal districts. So this is something that could have been stopped if by just the right vote. And unfortunately, my opponent didn't seem to see that as being fit.
Where do you stand in regard to Dominion's Atlantic Coast Pipeline?
The Atlantic Coast Pipeline is a flawed plan. From the very beginning, it hasn't really taken into consideration the precedent that it's going to create both as an environmental issue and as an engineering feat. This is such a big chore to have this big of a magnitude of an infrastructure coming in through our state that it should have had more insight than it has, because when the supervisor for the George Washington National Forest, Tom Speaks, comes up with 350 reasons that were issues and problems, then that should tell you that maybe this plan is something that should not go forward until it has demonstrated profit and also demonstrated necessity. And eminent domain, this is one of these big issues that I feel very strongly that that corporate profit shouldn't come before people's property. And this is what's happening right now, and there isn't anyone defending them except for themselves. They have no representation. They've had to take the giant by the tail and be able to get this done all by themselves, and I would like to know where that representation was.
This one's obviously from a senior statesman or a senior citizen. What will you do to make Virginia a more age-friendly state?
Well, the older population and the younger population is growing here, and we have a vested interest in both. Both give us the insights and the love of life that we all deserve and we all need, and we need to learn from each other. I've always encouraged my children and myself. I was encouraged by my mom and dad to develop a relationship with all ages, because we learn from each other and we really do prosper more with each other. But as our populations are growing, and they are growing here in Albemarle, because we have great hospitals, we have great schools, and we have a beautiful natural environment, we have to take care of these populations. And in order to take care of these populations, we've got to be able to get the funding that it deserves, so that that we have everything that our seniors will need to have a prosperous and a secure life, and as well as the growing population of children to have success in their schools and a vital future in a healthy environment. So we're all in this together, folks, and I think we can do this as a unit and as a homogeneous group of people who love this land and love our community.
What is your first political memory, and what sparked your interest in politics?
My first political memory, I've worked in working in external affairs. I worked with federal, state, and local officials coming into disasters where we're all together trying to make sure that the nonprofit groups and the faith-based groups and everybody who comes in gets the best job done at working together at a level that we're not overriding each other, but it's more collaborative. It's a very collaborative effort. And when I looked at how those things worked, I thought about when my kids were in school, I thought about school board and I thought about the things that I'd like to do, but I was very busy as a mom and busy as a teacher, so I put it off until my kids were grown. And now I have the energy, as you could see, and I have the passion and the desire to serve. So I want to put all of my talents to good use and serve the people of my community, my district, and my state.
What is the nicest thing you can say about your opponent?
It's nice that they created that agriculture forestry position, because I think Virginia has such a vested interest, and I have a vested interest in our farms and our forestry and our waters, and we need to be able to have somebody that's actually keeping a closer watch and dealing with legislature that can really bring these issues to the forefront. So I applaud him for getting that agriculture forestry piece together.
If you had a single question you could ask of your opponent, what would it be?
Where have you been? How come people don't know you? If you really wanted a challenge, and you said you did, then why aren't you here?
Is there anything you would tell the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors you would do differently as one of their representatives in the House of Delegates?
I believe that the supervisors have been given by my opponent 37 unfunded mandates and told to figure it out. You come up with the solutions. I would have a better idea of how to actually make government work, because it is from the localities and the people up, and also it has a flow from the federal government down. And that is the key ingredient in being a good government official, is keeping that flow. And I would ask that the localities communicate with me and I can communicate with them directly and not give them the responsibility of figuring out a problem that I should have been able to give them the solution for. I think I'm in the party of solutions, and I'm proud of that party, and I'm in the party of equality, and I'm proud of that part of it too.
Last question. Would you support giving Albemarle County taxing authority similar to that of cities in Virginia and some other urban counties?
I think that what we are doing now with our taxes, especially when it comes to having them raise the property taxes every time they get these unfunded mandates, has been wrong. So I think when it comes to the taxing authority here in the county, they're juggling. They're juggling with keeping people in their homes, the burden that it goes on to farmers, the idea that we have to take care of the population that's growing. As I mentioned, it's a great place to live, and it's growing. So the formulas that they've come up with try to be very fair, but they try to be able to juggle things that are beyond their reach without the extra funding from the state. So I wouldn't ask them to do something that places them in a position of being the ones that are the only solution-based group. It's a combined effort. So I'd have to visit with them and see what they thought, and I believe in them, and I know these supervisors well, and they're good people with solid minds and intelligence, and so I believe that they would have the leadership to come up with the right formula.
Angela Lynn, thank you very much for participating in this afternoon's forum. Now, if our two candidates for Commonwealth's attorney in Albemarle County would come forward, we have the last third of our program. The race for Albemarle County Commonwealth's attorney is contested in the November 3rd election. We have both candidates on the ballot. Robert Tracy is a candidate for the county Commonwealth's attorney's job. He served as Special Assistant U.S. Attorney in the Western District of Virginia, Charlottesville Division, as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the U.S. Department of Justice, and as Chief Antitrust Legislative Counsel and Parliamentarian to the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on the Judiciary. As counsel to the Judiciary Committee, he worked on federal legislation, including the Innocence Protection Act of 2004, the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act, the U.S. Patriot Reauthorization Act, the Voting Rights Reauthorization, and the Keeping the Internet Devoid of Sexual Predators Kids Act of 2008. He prosecuted hundreds of defendants for violations of Virginia law occurring on federal lands within the Western District of Virginia. He also was assigned responsibility for reviewing hundreds of motions for reductions of sentence for drug offenses. Denise Lunsford has been the Albemarle County Commonwealth's attorney for the past 8 years. She leads a team of prosecutors and staff who work with local law enforcement officers, court personnel, and other attorneys in the courts of Albemarle County. Her experience includes 25 years of practicing law in the state, local, and federal courts in the Charlottesville and Albemarle community. 8 years as Albemarle County Commonwealth's attorney, during which she's prosecuted cases and served as lead counsel in numerous complex criminal cases, including capital murder cases. She has worked with law enforcement and citizens groups to build a safer community, has co-chaired the Committee on Justice and Professionalism of the Virginia Association of Commonwealth's Attorneys. Denise Lunsford is a native of Cleveland, Tennessee. After graduating from the Washington and Lee University Law School, she moved to Charlottesville, where she began work at the firm of Mickey Hamlet, Lowry, Rasmussen, and Tweel. She's also taught as an adjunct professor in the University of Virginia Law School. Please welcome our two candidates for Commonwealth's attorney. We haven't flipped a coin, but how about if the challenger goes first?
Thank you all for, can you all hear me okay? Yep. Thank you all for being here. Thank you to the Senior Center for hosting this event, to the Virginia Elder Statesman for organizing and presenting this event, guests and supporters, particularly my biggest supporter, Megan, thank you for making time this afternoon, to Ms. Lunsford, thank you for being here. My name is Robert Tracy. I'm a candidate for Albemarle County Commonwealth's Attorney. Now, the role of the Commonwealth's attorney is to seek justice on behalf of all citizens. The quality of justice in our community is a measure of our values as a society. Justice, to my mind, is about swift and certain accountability for criminal misconduct. It's about community safety. It's about deterrence, prevention. It's also of no less importance about fundamental fairness and respect for the Constitution. Respecting victims of crime and their families, and preserving confidence in the fair and impartial administration of justice. Equal protection and due process under law, a presumption of innocence, a recognition that the government must prove every element of an offense guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, the affirmative obligation of a prosecutor to disclose exculpatory evidence to the defense in a criminal trial, the obligation of a prosecutor to be a minister of justice, not a mere advocate, and to nevertheless lose sight of the fact that the goal of the prosecutor is to pursue justice, not merely to convict. These principles are not only features of our criminal justice system, they are defining features of our civic identity as Americans. And when they are ignored or violated, compromised or discarded, we all suffer. And that is why I am running for Albemarle County Commonwealth's Attorney.
Thank you, Robert Tracy. Denise Lunsford.
No, you're not done, sir. You have another three minutes. Okay. Now, discretion is a very important part of the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office. They have broad discretion to determine what cases are brought and when, whether cases are tried or pled, whether to decline prosecutions, and to set priorities for the office. The exercise of this discretion requires integrity in upholding the public trust, judgment in determining what cases are brought and when, and fairness in according constitutional rights to all defendants in our community. I think this started working again. So there are limits to a prosecutor's discretion, however. The Constitution of Virginia and the United States, the rules of professional responsibility, the laws of the Commonwealth, the rules of procedure. And ultimately, the Virginia Constitution provides you all with the ultimate check on the role of a prosecutor. You all have an obligation every 4 years to uphold the quality of justice in your community. And I encourage each of you to exercise that right on November 3rd. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert Tracy. Denise Lunsford now.
Thank you. I'm Denise Lunsford. I am the Commonwealth's Attorney in Albemarle County. You know, when I walked into the office on January 1st of 2008 and assumed the responsibilities of Commonwealth's Attorney, I took on the responsibilities of the misdemeanor docket, which was somewhere between 75, 100, 150 cases per docket. I also assumed immediately the prosecution of a home invasion and robbery that had taken place the previous year and that was scheduled for trial in February. I assumed the responsibilities for the prosecution of that case alone. I sat in council chair alone, and I prosecuted that case successfully to a guilty verdict in front of a jury alone. The man got approximately 30 years for the sentence, or for the offenses. I also started immediately working to prosecute rape cases, murder cases, child pornography cases. Those were just during the first couple of years of the office. I got up immediately in the middle of the night to respond to phone calls. These were not things that I had to be trained to do. These were things that I was able to do based on my 25 years of experience as a lawyer in Virginia, 18 years at the time, handling some of the most difficult cases that came in front of our community as a defense attorney, and that gave me the experience to do that, to hit the ground running. The community expects to see the elected Commonwealth's Attorney out front in the lead on cases and at investigations from minute one. Does not expect to the elected Commonwealth's Attorney to need an assistant by his or her side, or to need the assistance of other attorneys when prosecuting those cases. During my 8 years as Commonwealth's Attorney, I have investigated and prosecuted child pornography, child sex abuse, rape cases. I have worked with the police department on special enforcement actions while also working to protect the privacy interests of citizens. I use I also created and worked with the police department to reinitiate the checkpoint policy. And it was very important when initiating this policy to make sure the officers were following the law, because it had been a number of years since we had had checkpoints in Albemarle County. And that was an incredibly important initiative within the first few months of the job. Important because it's important to remember last year in 2014, there were 229 DUI arrests in Albemarle County. We had 16 traffic fatalities, five of which were directly related to alcohol. So that was something that immediately needed to be done. The officers immediately asked to be done. That needed our community needed for the protection of our citizens. This is a small office. There's not one thing in this office that an assistant or a deputy does that I'm unwilling or unable to do. And that's very important because you have to lead from the front. You have to be, as the elected Commonwealth's attorney, the person who is up at 2 o'clock in the morning at a crime scene. You have to be the person making the decisions, whether those decisions seem trivial at the time and the phone call is about a misdemeanor, or whether they're incredibly important and pertain to a murder case. In addition to prosecuting cases over the past 8 years, my office has performed community outreach. We've worked with the schools on issues such as bullying, with the schools and with the police department on the AWARE program, which is always watch and recognize your environment. We've educated parents about cyber stalking, about child pornography and other things that they should be aware of on the internet. I've obtained grants for a victim's rights observation week. I obtained funding for a courthouse dog to allow us to have that service available to victims and witnesses in our community. In addition, I've improved the communication of my office with the police department. When I first came into office, there was a sort of a lack of communication, a lack of trust, if you will, between the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office and the police department, and I felt it was important to sort of breach that divide. In doing so, one of the things I insisted was that my attorneys go to the police department once a week during the week that they're on call, during the 24/7 carrying the phone week, and they spend 4 or 5 hours at the police department, allowing the police officers to come in and ask them questions. That did two things. One, it eliminated the need for the police to always come to us when they had an issue or to call. They could just think of things and we were there. The second thing it did was show the police department that we cared, that we valued their time, that we valued the efforts that they were putting into the case, and we were willing to come to them so that we could be available to them.
Thank you, Denise.
Thank you.
Starting with Denise and then going to Robert, should there be more traffic law enforcement in Albemarle County? Should there be more red light cameras? And do you believe Albemarle should have speed cameras?
I'm not familiar with speed cameras. I do think there should be more traffic enforcement in Albemarle County. Ned Galloway talked about the number of police officers on the street. We have 740 square miles in Albemarle County. There are 124, I think at last count, sworn officers. On any given night, there are approximately 8 officers working the 740 square miles of Albemarle County. That makes for long response time. In nighttime, when they're having to respond to domestic cases, assaults, or work a DUI, makes it much more difficult for the officers to do traffic enforcement on things such as speed, which has been an issue in fatalities that we've had. So, yes, I do support measures for more traffic enforcement.
Robert?
I agree with that sentiment. I do think there should be aggressive enforcement of traffic laws, not only in the county, but in the city and on the 250 bypass as well. Let that be a lesson to folks here. I had a speeding violation the other day in a zone that went from 45 to 25, along with 170 other people, I think, that day. And I think why that was newsworthy is because I'm running for the Office of Commonwealth's Attorney, and the Commonwealth's Attorney has to be held to a higher standard. And I'm asking all of you to do that this November 3rd.
Thank you both. We'll start with you for this one, Robert. How has your trial experience distinguished you from that of your opponent?
Well, she has more trial experience, but I'm extremely proud of every trial that I ever worked on. As a Special Assistant United States Attorney, I was given responsibility of a full range of issues, from violent offenses to illegal possession of firearms. I co-counseled a case pertaining to solicitation, a murder for hire, witness tampering, obstruction of justice. As you mentioned in the introduction, I handled a broad range of cases in the George Washington National Parkway. We apply in federal court state law to ensure that people in the parkway are held accountable for their violations there. So I do have courtroom experience. I've appeared before Judge Krigler, before district court on several occasions. I handled matters before the grand jury. And I also think, as a prosecutor, we need to bring a measure of civility and humility to our task, because the prosecutor exercises enormous power on behalf of all of us. When he or she brings a case, he or she does not do so in a personal capacity. He does so on your behalf, on our behalf. And when he violates that obligation, that person should be held accountable.
Thank you. Denise?
I've spent my entire legal career in this community as a trial attorney. I was hired in the year 2019, sadly, as a commercial litigation attorney with the firm of Mickey Hamlet. About 8 years later, we all realized that my passion was not commercial litigation. My passion was criminal litigation, which I had done when I was at Mickey Hamlet. So for 25 years, and exclusively for the last 18 years, I have handled the most serious cases in this community. When I left Mickey Hamlet, I began my own practice handling robberies, handling rapes, handling murder cases, and capital murder cases in federal court and in state court here in this community. So all that experience it allows me to walk into any case, whether it's the night that an offense was committed, needing to help direct an investigation to know what resources the police officers have, so that I can know which police officers to call in on a particular case, to determining which charges to bring based on that experience and based on my education, to knowing how to prosecute the case fairly and effectively, and knowing when to back off and knowing when to change course when necessary.
Thank you. We'll start with you, Denise Lunsford, on this question. Do you agree that a prosecutor needs to be able to evaluate a case from both the prosecution and the defense perspective? How many felony cases, in how many felony cases have you been the lead prosecutor, and how many felony cases have you been the lead defense attorney?
Did I mention 25 years? I don't know if I can count that many. I have been involved in well over a dozen capital cases. I've been lead counsel on, I think it's 4 or 5 capital cases, primarily here in this area and in the Valley. I've been involved in probably hundreds of felony cases and certainly dozens of trials in this area, all criminal related.
Does a prosecutor need to be able to evaluate a case from both the prosecution and the defense perspective?
Yes, and that's a very good point. I'm glad you reminded me of that. And in being able to anticipate what the defense might do in a given case, I can better prepare a prosecution. I can also evaluate the case to determine if some different actions should be taken, whether we should continue with a prosecution or discontinue a prosecution. There have been cases during my term in office where charges were brought, and on further evaluation, sometimes very quickly, sometimes not so quickly, we've determined that a prosecution was simply not appropriate for one reason or another, and the ability to evaluate those cases from both the defense perspective and the prosecution perspective allows for a much better outcome, which allows for a safer community.
Thank you. Robert Tracy, same multi-part question.
Yes, I do agree that the government should examine a case from the perspective of the prosecution and the defense, and I should hasten to add that I had more experience prosecuting cases in court now than Denise did when she ran for Commonwealth's attorney 8 years ago. I want to take exception with a couple of things Ms. Lunsford said. She indicated that she knows when to back off on cases. And I want to bring to everyone's attention an article here from Dahlia Lithwick at Slate.com, July 16th. It's called When Prosecutors Believe the Unbelievable. And it has to do with the Mark Weiner case. And there's a quote here that's really unusual in its how clear it is. They're talking about the growing mountain of exculpatory evidence in the Weiner matter. The fact that there was a trial at all is remarkable. I don't think that indicates recognition of when it's a good idea to back off a case. In addition, Deidre Enright, the director of investigation for the University of Virginia School of Law Innocence Project Clinic, said the following, quote, "This was the kind of exculpatory evidence that could cause a would cause a fair prosecutor, honoring her obligation to seek and serve justice, to dismiss the charge. Instead, she successfully argued against their admissibility in court." So I think it's important for the government to always be cognizant of the enormous power it brings to bear when it arrays the coercive power of the state against an individual.
Denise Lunsford, your response?
I am aware of the great power that is inherent in this office. There is the power to decide to go forward with a prosecution or the power not to go forward with the prosecution. What I'm also aware of is there are quite often many, many, many facts that go into a determination of how to proceed in a case that the public is not aware of, especially as in the case of Ms. Lithwick, when the reporter doesn't call an attorney who was directly involved in a case to get a comment on the matter. Additionally, there are procedural matters that must be followed in court. There are rules that require that we bring certain witnesses in order to have certain evidence admitted into admitted before the jury. And the reason for that is the reliability of the testimony, the reliability of the evidence. We want to make sure that the evidence is the most reliable, and then the witnesses who can speak fully to those matters are the best witnesses that are available. They can give the fullest color, if you will, to the picture. And those rules apply to the prosecution, but they also apply to the defendant, to the defense in a particular case. So it's important to have been there. It's important to have known what was going on before casting doubt on the decisions that were made. It's also important to have known all the facts that went into a decision before deciding whether the decision was right or wrong.
Thank you. We'll continue on that line of questioning for a moment, starting with you, Robert Tracy. What did the police, if anything, do wrong in the Mark Weiner case, and are there any steps that you would take to prevent those from being encountered in the future?
I don't think the police did anything wrong in the Mark Weiner case. And as a matter of fact, I issued a press release taking exception with Ms. Lunsford's decision to blame the police for the Mark Weiner case. As a matter of fact, this case is probably in the public record because a detective brought to the attention of the defense attorney his belief that this defendant was being prosecuted based on evidence that was inconsistent with the government's theory of the case. When that detective was subpoenaed to testify, Ms. Lunsford objected and did not permit him to do so.
Denise Lunsford?
That is highly inconsistent and irregular, to say the least. Later, after denying him a new trial, and I agree that a jury verdict ought to be entitled to a level of deference, but that level of deference must be predicated on a full, fair, and complete record. No one has argued that that exists in this case. Secondly, Ms. Lunsford opposed a motion for a new trial based on new evidence as one of the evidentiary bases to receive a new trial. A few weeks later, she joined a defense motion to vacate the case entirely, claiming that a drug transaction that occurred 2.5 years later was, quote, the straw that broke the camel's back. Now, any prosecutor that thinks the burden of proof the government must establish can be broken by a straw doesn't really understand the burden of proof the government needs to prove a defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. This case has brought serious attention to the quality of justice in our community, and I encourage you all to read this article. Take an honest look at what happened. We do not try defendants based on secret evidence in our country or in this county, and I want you to take a fair look, appraise the facts, and render your own decision on the quality of justice in our community on November 3rd. Thank you.
Denise Lunsford, what, if anything, did the police do wrong in the Mark Weiner case?
The police didn't do anything wrong in the Mark Weiner case, and I never said that the officers did do anything wrong. It's a very nuanced point, and I understand that. But what happened was when police came forward with information in July of this year that had been known to the police since February of this year, but had not been communicated to my office for reasons that are entirely appropriate in the type of investigation that was taking place, and that is a drug investigation where the names of informants and the names of people from whom drugs are purchased are simply not made known. They're kept very close to the vest, to the judge, with the JADE, the Jefferson Area Drug Enforcement Task Force. So the police did know something in February that I didn't know. And in July, when I found that out, I had to make a decision about whether or not to go forward and to continue to try to uphold that decision. Legally, I could have made that argument, and I believe the judge would have agreed with me and would have maintained the conviction and not vacated the conviction. At that point, however, it was a decision about the confidence in the judicial system that all of you have. I had to make a judgment as to whether or not that case, one case, out of the thousands of cases that the office handles on a yearly basis, was worth eroding confidence in the judicial system based on something that I didn't know, but am legally charged with knowing. And as I say, that's a very nuanced point. The police did exactly what they were supposed to do. They were investigating a case. They kept that information to themselves. That case concerned the victim. What happened was, when I didn't get information about the case that they were investigating relating to the victim, I proceeded because I didn't know about it. But I'm legally responsible for having that information, even though I didn't. So that was the basis on which I joined in the motion to vacate. It was the confidence in the judicial system that I felt was being eroded by that particular case.
Brief response, Mr. Tracy.
Two quick things. The role of the prosecutor is to look at each case and ascertain the strength of each case. It's not to do a public opinion poll and say, does the public have confidence in a particular case or not. Assume things were reversed and everyone thought that this gentleman was guilty rather than innocent. Would the Commonwealth's attorney indicate that the best way to restore integrity of the process would be to indict the person? Of course not. She has the ultimate responsibility to ascertain the strengths and merits of each case. Second, I don't understand how it's possible. It strains credulity, to say the very least, that a drug conviction or a drug, not even a conviction, an allegation of a transaction 2.5 years after the alleged abduction is somehow relevant and creates some sort of Brady disclosure obligation on part of the government. You can look through the case law and find no parallel. It's just inconsistent, and it sends a very dangerous message to victims of sexual abuse that if you are involved in drugs, you are not going to be believed by this Commonwealth's attorney. It is a dangerous message. It was worse than pretextual. I think a better explanation is necessary at the very least. Thank you.
Short answer, Mrs. Lunsford.
My office and I, as the elected Commonwealth's attorney, take sex abuse cases and the information provided to us by victims very seriously, which is exactly why this case was prosecuted to begin with. When a defendant, when someone who is charged with a crime says, I didn't do it, the responsibility of the prosecutor is not to throw up their hands and go, oh, well, he says he didn't do it, so I'm going to completely disregard everything that this victim says. Secondly, there is a Brady obligation. It continues until there is a final judgment, and really in some cases can continue thereafter based on when the information was obtained and when the events arose. So that Brady obligation, I know it might be difficult to understand how information about a situation that happened 2 years after the offense was Brady. Again, it's a nuanced point, but the case was not closed at that point. That's why I had an obligation under Brady to make sure that the defense knew about this, and an obligation to make sure that action was taken.
Thank you. This one goes first to you, Denise Lunsford. Do you personally support the death penalty, and would you bring it in every case where aggravating factors exist?
Personally, I for many years worked as an opponent to the death penalty. I did mitigation in capital cases, helping defense attorneys develop a theory under which their client should not be executed. I think my personal opinion on the death penalty has changed over the course probably of the past 9 years. No, I don't think it's appropriate to bring a capital charge in every situation in which it could be brought. One has to consider the resources that are expended. One has to consider the defendant and what might be brought to light with respect to his background, with respect to this particular offense. But in appropriate cases, I think it's absolutely necessary.
Same question, Mr. Tracy.
My personal views on the death penalty are irrelevant to my role as a prosecutor. The role of a prosecutor is to uphold the law and apply it as it is, not how the prosecutor might want it to be.
Next question for Mr. Tracy first. If you could ask the General Assembly to pass one law for criminal justice reform, what would it be and why?
I have been very privileged to get to know Sheriff Chip Harding over the last several weeks and months. And I am in a big support of expanding the DNA database to better to allow the police and law enforcement to better prosecute crime, but also to ensure against wrongful conviction. DNA database expansion has been supported in a bipartisan manner. The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, just signed a bill to expand DNA database to misdemeanor offenses. Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin, on the other side of the political spectrum, as many of you know, has done the same thing. So I think we need to do a better job being proactive about expanding the DNA database to ensure against wrongful convictions, to solve cold cases, and to give prosecutors and police the tools they need to keep our community safer.
Same question, Denise Lunsford.
I would ask that the General Assembly pass a law allowing for more problem-solving courts. One of the things that was talked about in one of the earlier candidate forums today was the number of persons with serious mental illness in our jails and in our justice system. A mental health court could, along the lines of a drug court, help our communities keep the individuals out of jail who have serious mental illness that have contributed to their offenses. It can help those individuals get back on the road to recovery, get back on medication in some cases, back in counseling in other cases, so that they don't commit crimes in the future, first of all, and recidivism is reduced, but secondly, they are able to maintain a better and more consistent lifestyle for themselves and their families.
Thank you. Next question, we'll start with you, Denise Lunsford. What has been your most valuable experience in a trial, and what did you learn from it?
My most valuable experience in a trial. The self-deprecating answer to that is not to put my hands in my hair when I have a pen in my hand at the same time. My daughter, who is here today, Addie, was present at a trial. I ran my hands through my hair. I often also happen to have a pen in my hand, and the pen got caught in my hair. I think the serious answer is learning the impact that a trial has on everyone. I was involved in a rape trial a couple of years ago. It was an allegation of stranger rape and abduction. The gentleman was convicted. The victim testified. At the end of that testimony, I learned a few days later One of the jurors went home that night and was simply unable to function. He was unable to communicate with his wife and child. He really didn't want to come back the next day to sentencing because of what he had experienced, what he had heard from this victim and sort of experienced vicariously, second and third hand. I'm involved in another case right now where I'm seeing that kind of impact on others, people who are what I would refer to as civilians who are not involved directly in a case as a witness or as a victim. But it's very difficult for a lot of people to sit and listen to what we hear on a daily basis. And I think that was probably a very valuable experience to me to kind of learn the impact that just hearing the words about what happened have on others in the courtroom.
Thank you. Robert Tracy, same question.
When I handled the magistrate court docket in federal court, it's sort of like general district court in the state system. You handle dozens of cases on a single day. And sometimes the cases look the same. People are violating the law and the citations look the same. But it's absolutely essential to remind yourself with every case that that individual deserves the individual scrutiny that the Constitution demands, to never lose sight of that fact. And I also had that recognition when I handled these 3582 motions for reduction of sentence under the crack powder guidelines in federal law. The Sentencing Commission, I know it sounds boring, but it was very important. They reduced the sentences for nonviolent crack offenders in the federal system. Western District of Virginia was one of the largest districts per capita in the country to prosecute those cases. And looking at those files reminded me that every person deserved that kind of equal protection and due process under law. So never lose sight of the fact that every individual deserves that constitutional right and the constitutional rights that are accorded to them. That was the biggest lesson I had.
Thank you. Next question, we'll start with you, Robert Tracy. What is your position on the Supreme Court's revocation of a major portion of the 1965 Voting Rights Act?
Well, I worked directly on the Voting Rights Reauthorization Act. My former chairman, Jim Sensenbrenner, was a proponent of ensuring that it was reauthorized for another 25 years. I think the will of Congress is fairly clear that when creating districts, the composition of districts ought to be considered. So I think the Supreme Court looked at that decision, they looked at how things have evolved over the last 20 years or so, and did not uphold that preclearance requirement under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. However, I do think that the Voting Rights Act and the imperative to ensure that every American is accorded the right to vote is absolutely essential, and folks should not lose sight of that. President Reagan, when signing the Voting Rights Reauthorization Act in the early 80s, said that voting is the crown jewel of American liberties. It is, and we shouldn't lose sight of it.
Can you repeat the question again?
Yes. What is your position on the Supreme Court's revocation of a major portion of the 1965 Voting Rights Act?
I think I'll speak to that insofar as it relates to my office because and voting as it relates to my office, because there are a lot of duties in my office that a lot of people don't know about. One of the duties is to work with people who have been denied the ability to register to vote. Specifically what the statute says is if someone is denied the ability to register to vote by the registrar for whatever reason, they can petition the circuit court for an appeal of that decision. And it specifically says that the Commonwealth's attorney shall oppose that. I sort of take oppose as a broad view, and there were have been a number of people over the course of the past 8 years that have been denied the right to vote that actually have the ability to vote. And so we worked with them to get them registered so that they could exercise that right. By the same token, when we have people who recently attempted to register to vote who were not eligible to do so, we prosecuted those cases. But in doing so, I also tried to bear in mind that they were eligible to register to vote after they had gone through some other steps. They had waited the appropriate period of time. Their felonies were quite old. They simply hadn't gone through the steps. We were able to help those, we were able to prosecute those cases because they had violated the law, but we were also able to educate those people as to how they might go ahead and register to vote.
Thank you. Next question, we'll start with you, Denise Lunsford. Are there any major cases handed down within the past year by the U.S. Supreme Court with which you take serious issue?
As it relates to my office, no. We try to stay abreast of what the most recent case law is in both the Supreme Court of the United States and the Supreme Court of Virginia and the Court of Appeals of Virginia, and we try to work within that. We try to realize, and when I say we, again, it's a very small office. I have five or six other attorneys, five and a half other attorneys in the office. We try to understand that we're not legislators, that we're not appellate court judges, that we're not Supreme Court justices. So we try to work within the framework of the case law as it comes down and the laws that the General Assembly passes. We don't try to reinvent or decide not to prosecute particular laws or not to abide by particular decisions. So I can't say there's any that I personally disagree with. Simply that we try to enforce both the statutes as well as uphold the case law.
Thank you. Reverend Tracy?
I revert to the early answer I provided, which is the role of a prosecutor is to apply the law as it is and not how he or she might want it to be.
We'll start with you, Reverend Tracy. How does your political party, Republican in your case, affect this job?
It doesn't.
Denise Lunsford?
It doesn't, and it shouldn't. And for the past 8 years, I've tried to make sure that I've made decisions without regard to my personal political affiliation or without regard to the political affiliation of the particular people involved.
Can I elaborate on that just briefly?
Go ahead.
You know, this is Albemarle County. This is Thomas Jefferson's home. And the law has got to be a source of civic unity, not a weapon of political division. That should be clear to everybody here. I have been very encouraged by the bipartisan support I've received. I hope I have a question on elder law issues because Ms. Doris Geldman, who is a luminary of the Senior Center, is a supporter of mine, and I respect her opinion and am very grateful for her support, even though on political issues we probably don't agree on every single point, you think? So the Commonwealth's attorney position is an elected one. It must not be political. So partisan affiliation shouldn't matter. It's about policy, not partisanship. It's about policy, not politics.
Thank you. Two more questions. The first, we'll start with Denise Lunsford. Please detail steps that you've taken to stem a flood of crimes, abuse, financial exploitation against elderly, and the results thereof.
Our office has done a number of things. In addition to reaching out to organizations like JABA and the Senior Center to educate people on offenses against the elderly, working with the Department of Social Services, Adult Protective Services, to identify when there has been issues related to elderly, whether it is abuse that is physical or abuse that is financial. We have tried to work very hard with those organizations, also with Triad, to make sure that senior citizens know how to protect themselves, both in their personal surroundings and when they can call the police. And we certainly always encourage people to call the police when they know of or suspect criminal activity. Beyond that, in my office, I have worked to create an organization or a collaborative, if you will, of bank security officers, of law enforcement, and of Commonwealth's attorneys who work to sort of detect suspicious criminal activity insofar as financial institutions are concerned while it's happening so that we can investigate and work to reach out to protect people. Through that organization, we were able to determine in one particular case that there was an older gentleman in the community who had literally sent hundreds of thousands of dollars out of his personal account overseas in the desire to help people who really didn't exist. He was essentially the victim of an internet scam. And so we were able to reach out to that individual to prevent further loss of money and to educate him and others on exactly what was happening. So it's through those proactive efforts that our office, my office, has worked very hard in trying to educate and prevent those types of crimes.
Thank you, Robert. Tracy, tweaking the question for you, what steps would you take to stem the flood of crimes against the elderly?
Well, as I mentioned, I would work with Doris Geldman to identify ways to better address the issue of elder abuse and exploitation. I would establish a task force. We don't have to look far. Augusta County has a task force dealing precisely with this issue. It's comprised of law enforcement representatives, community organizations, and others to look at the issue of elder abuse. Albemarle County is among the nicest places in the country to retire. It must be the safest. And the Commonwealth's attorney has an obligation to ensure that elderly people can live with the dignity that they deserve and expect. We should bring more cases, monitor abuse, allow people in senior centers and elsewhere to know that the Commonwealth's attorney is their ally. They can report abuse anonymously if necessary, proactively engage with staff and others to say there will be strict accountability for anyone who abuses, exploits our senior citizens, period.
Last question. Robert Tracy, what is the nicest thing you can say about your opponent?
I think she cares, and I think that's important. She works hard. And that's very important as well. I think sometimes that zeal can create situations that aren't good for the quality of justice in our community. I also think that she has done a good job trying to obtain more resources for the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office. Over the last several years, we've seen a huge increase in the volume caseload, just like in the federal system. But this is one thing I wouldn't do. If I were Commonwealth's attorney, I would never condition the prosecution of domestic violence cases upon an increase in taxpayer funds, like Ms. Lunsford did in 2009. She went to the Board of Supervisors and said, look, you know, domestic violence, drunk driving cases are issues that are of importance. We have discretion to bring misdemeanor cases. We'd like to try these cases, but if you do not approve this much money in this much time, we will not prosecute or may not prosecute these cases. The article is October 8, 2009, WHSV.com. I've got it for anyone who's interested. I certainly wouldn't do that. Thank you.
Denise Lunsford, now a two-part question. What's the nicest thing you can say about your opponent, and would you like to respond to what was just raised?
And I'll respond to what was just raised first. When I came into the office of Commonwealth's attorney, there was the elected Commonwealth's attorney, and I think at that point, four other Commonwealth's attorney's assistants. As Ned Galloway pointed out, what we've consistently seen over the course of the years is unfunded mandates that are passed down not just in the area of education, but in the area of public safety and specifically directly to the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office. In my term of office, we've recently been put in charge of a multidisciplinary team, which we already had in Albemarle County. We've been using the multidisciplinary team approach with respect to child abuse and assault cases for a decade or more. But it was a mandate from the General Assembly that even offices that were much smaller than mine that didn't have the resources for those sorts of teams to a demand, essentially, that those be created and that the Commonwealth's attorney be in charge of those. There's also the Sexual Assault Resource Team, which is another mandate that was put into place in the past 8 years that, again, the Commonwealth's attorney is responsible for. So when we have more and more responsibilities and more police officers that are being added to the force, it creates more and more work for us. The Commonwealth's attorney is mandated by statute only to prosecute felony cases. The Commonwealth's attorney is not statutorily mandated to prosecute Class 1 and 2 felonies. It's something that I feel, that my office feels, is incredibly important to this community. But the fact of the matter is, when the General Assembly creates a mandate and requires that we head certain teams and that we have certain things in place, we have to make a choice. that was the choice that had to be made. It was not a threat. It was simply a discussion with the Board of Supervisors that if we didn't have more resources made available to us, we were going to have to make some very serious decisions in the office. And I think the question was, what's the nicest thing I can say about Mr. Tracy?
Nicest thing you can say about Mr. Tracy.
I only met Mr. Tracy on July 4th of this year, so I'm sorry to say that I don't really know that much about him, either as an attorney or as a person. It's my understanding, however, that he has taken time away from work for his family over the course of the past several years, that he has stayed at home with his child. And I think that's not only a nice thing, it's something that I really admire in a person. I don't have the capability within myself to do that. I'm always thinking about other things. And in fact, if I had one regret about the office, it would be the amount of time that it takes away from the family, because it does actually require 110% commitment of your time, willing to leave birthday parties at the last minute and get up in the middle of the night. So I admire someone who was able to take that time to spend with his family.
Thank you both for participating in this afternoon's forum.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.